to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program, Very Remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 22nd, 2021. A senior police officer escaped dead narrowly in the South Sudan's capital, Juba.
When he heard his head, he just saw him coming and then trying to shoot him. He missed him, like four bullets, but he managed to just get a cover behind a house in the room.
And some Sudanese women complain about discrimination.
I listened to the stories. I felt the suffering in my heart. But I also saw the hope in their eyes.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Police officers in the South Sudan capital, Juba, shot and killed their colleague who wanted to shoot his boss at the South Sudan police headquarters on Tuesday. A police spokesperson says the officer who attempted to shoot his superior was off duty and was not supposed to have a gun. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino has the details from Juba.
Major General Daniel Justin, spokesperson of the South Sudan National Police Service, says the police officer who shot General Mangar is normally based in northern Barakazal State, but had come to Juba on leave and the officer requested to continue working while in Juba. Justin says the officer was allowed to work in the IT department for several weeks. He says the police officer's leave days had expired, but he asked for an extension and was allowed to continue to work at the department. He says before 8 a.m. this morning, while other officers were on patrol on the other side of the building, the warrant officer tried to shoot his boss who was seated within the compound.
So he was seated outside and then he was actually going over the report he was reading. So when he raised his head, he just saw him coming and then trying to shoot him. He missed him, like four bullets, but he managed to just get a cover behind a house, a room. And then the other forces, he was asked to surrender himself, but he started shooting also.
Justin says no one was hurt during the incident. He says Mangar, the officer, told him he does not know why the officer tried to shoot him, saying they have been good friends working in the same department.
This is what he's saying. He is a very friend to him. Usually in the morning, sometimes he comes and asks for little money for tea and so on. So there is nothing completely which shows that he was angry or there is something between them.
Justin says it's not clear where the officer obtained his gun since weapons of off-duty officers are locked up. He says the storekeeper was within the compound and that it is a trend that police officers submit their guns every morning before going for assembly.
Well, the situation is calm here. There is nothing. Just investigating how he managed to get the gun and so on, because he was not on the duty. So far, the investigation will show us more about the motives. He will investigate all his colleagues and how he managed to get the gun.
Jacob Chol, a professor of political science at the University of Juba, says it's unfortunate to have a repeat of what happened in Bilfa military headquarters when a bodyguard and his boss exchanged fires a few weeks ago. He says he believes junior officers started turning against their bosses because of the frustrations they experience in relation to the economic conditions since they have not been paid in months.
They are not being motivated. They feel that they are just doing job voluntarily. And you understand that some of these senior security military officers, they are not like their own guard. They might have privileges that, of course, they enjoy than even the junior officers. So the junior officers could feel more frustrated. So when they are command or they are being ordered to do something, which they believe that is not beneficial to them, then they turn against their own bosses.
Charles says generals or soldiers in high ranks should consider that junior soldiers are human too and that they deserve to be respected, but that soldiers should behave according to the law of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
South Sudan has resumed oil production at Tarjat oil field after 7 years. The facility was shut down in 2013 when war broke out in the country. South Sudan's petroleum minister says the oil field known as Block 5A will produce 3,000 barrels of crude oil per day. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar has more from Juba.
Speaking Monday at the ceremony marking the resumption of oil production at the Tarjat oil field, Erwan Gerry, president of the Sud Petroleum Operating Company, says the company faced enormous challenges getting to this day.
This simple yet important event today signifies that ESPOC has finally resumed production after very challenging and trying, almost 8 years in shutdown. 8 years in shutdown. We never lost hope that we will return to Tarjat to continue our ESPOC legacy, to be here for the community, to be here for MOP and ESPOC partners, and to be here for the Republic of South Sudan. Now all our dreams have come true.
Gerry says the company expects to produce up to 8,000 barrels per day by the end of 2021. Oil production at the oil field stopped in 2013 when the area turned into a fierce battleground between rebels and government forces. South Sudan Petroleum Minister Port Kang says the resumption of oil production at Block 5A will make a significant contribution to the country's economy and development.
Resumption to us as a government means economic security. Not only to the government of the Republic of South Sudan, but as well to the communities in the vicinities of oil producing areas. It also means security to us. Like it was said earlier by the governor of Warabi State, if all of these young people are working, if we engage all of them, nobody will fight. So it means security to us. But most importantly, it means development.
In the beginning, the Block 5A oil well will only produce 3,000 barrels a day, but Kang says Sud Petroleum hopes to increase that amount to 16,000 barrels per day in the near future. He says the war that erupted in 2013 hurt South Sudan's domestic production, which pushed the country into extreme debt.
The damage we have done to ourselves, the 2013 crisis, have contributed negatively toward the delivery of services to our people. In a sense that we have entered into debt that we were supposed not to enter into. And today, we have companies, we have banks that would walk to my office and the Ministry of Finance and take all the cargoes because we have signed such agreements with them.
Warab State Governor Aleu Ayanya Aleu says oil revenues should be shared with oil-producing communities and states to avoid future crises in the country.
If the percentage that was meant for civilians or for citizens who come from oil-producing areas was given to them from the beginning, there would not have been war. Everybody would have been very busy doing his own business because if the oil was shared correctly, we would not have fought. So with the flow of this oil here, Cameron Minister, the 5% man for the people here should not be interfered with.
Oil-producing states are entitled to 3% and oil-producing communities are entitled to 2% of oil revenues, according to South Sudan's transitional constitution. Petroleum Minister Kang distanced himself and the Petroleum Ministry from the handling of oil revenues.
We don't give money as the Ministry of Petroleum. We only sell crude and the money does not come to us. The money goes to the public treasury. That is the Ministry of Finance. But we are working, and the two ministers know that there was a time I went to the council, presented this, and the council said, we should remove what belongs to communities, what belongs to estates. But when it is where from Juba to the estates, if anything happened in the air, you don't blame also us.
South Sudan produces between 165,000 and 170,000 barrels per day. Oil accounts for 98% of South Sudan revenue. The country was hard hit by lower international oil prices in 2020, combined with an already devastated economy due to the 5.5-year civil war. The current price of a barrel of Nile Blend crude is between $40 and $70. The audio used in this story was provided by the press unit at the Petroleum Ministry. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where the Sudanese transitional government has renewed its commitment to end all forms of sexual violence against women. Sudan's Minister for Social Development, Ahmed Adam Bakit, says the government has eliminated laws that oppressed women and will enact new laws that will criminalize sexual abuse of women and girls. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
On Sunday, the world commemorated International Day to eliminate all forms of sexual violence against women. In Sudan, authorities used the event to reiterate their commitment to end gender-based violence and other sexual violence against women and girls. Speaking Sunday at a news conference in Khartoum, Social Development Minister Bakit said Sudan wants to end all forms of gender-based violence in the country. Bakit says his ministry will ensure that victims and survivors of sexual violence get the services they need, and says the government will work with other legal entities to bring the perpetrators to justice.
It is very important that we establish with these efforts a clear way to transitional justice in Sudan, which is based on justice for the victims and which preserves the rights of survivors, promotes healing and rehabilitation through a comprehensive approach that is gender sensitive.
Bakit says his ministry has approved a national plan to implement United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security, and sign a common framework agreement with the UN to end sexual violence in conflicted affected areas. The government also approved common standard procedures for addressing and responding to cases of gender-based violence. Last month, Sudan agreed to ratify the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, with reservations on some articles. Sudanese women activists regarded the move as a major achievement in the fight for women's rights in the country. Speaking at Sunday's news conference, the head of the UN Population Fund in Sudan, Masio Diana, applauded the government for taking practical steps to reform laws that protect women and girls in Sudan. Diana says sexual violence is a human rights violation and should be punishable by law. He says victims of sexual violence often live in a consistent state of pain, especially when the perpetrators are not arrested.
Repeated exposure to such violence disrupts social ties, compounds the shame and feelings of humiliation the individuals already feel because of displacement, loss of personal security and livelihoods. Sexual violence needs to be addressed in a comprehensive, multisectoral way that considers the physical, mental, social and economic effects of violence on survivors.
Diana says his agency has documented thousands of cases of sexual violence among women and girls in Sudan who often flee their homes and end up as internally displaced persons or refugees who are then exposed to other types of violence. He says during a recent visit to war-affected areas across Sudan, he heard horrible testimonies from some survivors of sexual violence.
I listened to the stories. I felt the suffering in my heart, but I also saw the hope in their eyes. All the women and girls I met have one thing in common, a strong will to survive, but truth and justice must be served so that survivors can move forward without any stigma.
Suleyma Al Khalifa, who heads Sudan's gender department at the Ministry of Social Development, says the ministry is working with the various agencies to ensure that services are provided to victims and survivors of sexual violence in conflict areas.
These services include life-saving health services, reproductive health services, psychosocial support, livelihoods, social and economic reintegration, access to justice and high accountability, and rule of law.
In 2015, the UN General Assembly proclaimed June 19th of each year the International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict to raise awareness needed to put an end to conflict-related sexual violence and to honor the victims and survivors of sexual violence. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, how is Uganda battling a third wave of COVID-19? Find out more after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. And in our Tuesday health segment, we take a look at how Uganda is struggling to fight a third wave of COVID-19. Uganda's Minister of Health is blaming the public's failure to take precautions for an increase in COVID-19 cases that is stretching the country's hospitals and oxygen supplies. Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng also welcomed France's donation of 175 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, saying it comes at a crucial time. For VOA News, Alima Thumani reports from Kampala.
France has donated 175,200 doses of the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine to Uganda as part of the COVAX facility sharing agreement among countries. As of June 14th, Uganda had vaccinated 806,129 people. Health Minister Jane Ruth Acheng says the delivery of the vaccine is very timely, considering Uganda is facing the wrath of the coronavirus. While receiving the vaccine Thursday, Acheng said the situation in which Uganda is in requires all hands to come together and address the pandemic. She, however, puts the blame on Ugandan citizens.
Ugandans were not listening when we were saying we have variants in the country. And the variants give you 2 months as it is spreading. Thereafter, the result is what we are seeing. No amount of oxygen, no amount of vaccines, no increasing ICU beds will get us out of this situation.
Uganda is expected to receive another 688,000 doses in August from the COVAX facility. Munir Safdian, the UNICEF country representative, says that even though Uganda expects more vaccines in coming months, Ugandans need to continue protecting themselves by wearing masks, washing hands, and social distancing if they are to survive the coronavirus.
That vaccines are coming in and they will keep coming in. But there is another vaccine that is available in the hands of every citizen already. Follow the standard operational procedure to protect yourself.
On Monday of this week, reports of vaccine theft emerged, with the Uganda police saying they had arrested 10 people in connection with the theft of 600 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. In its latest figures, Uganda registered over 1,100 COVID-19 cases, with 950 active cases being treated in health facilities across the country. Uganda has registered 508 deaths, with the highest number of deaths in one day being registered at 49 on Monday of this week. Jules Amand Aniambuso, the French ambassador to Uganda, says France will continue supporting Uganda.
Vaccine should become a global common good. To vaccinate all the world, we should work on it. Then it is the responsibility of the Western developing country to provide the vaccine, to provide oxygen, to provide masks.
Uganda is also facing a medical oxygen supply crisis for its patients in intensive care units, leading to even more deaths. Officials from the Ministry of Health this week revealed that the government had received $7 million from the Global Fund to set up 7 oxygen plants across the country. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Still on COVID, in a report this month, the World Bank predicts Zimbabwe's economy will grow 3.9% this year, even as the country sees an alarming rise in poverty levels, especially in urban areas. The report says a record 7.9 million Zimbabweans are extremely poor, earning less than $30 a month. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the government says decent rainfall will help lift the agro-based economy with abundant harvest.
41-year-old Richard Luzani is one of many unemployed Zimbabweans hoping the economy will recover and that the coronavirus pandemic will end soon. Each day, he pushes a cart full of water buckets while selling the scarce precious liquid in Headcliff, one of the poorest suburbs of Harare. He works with his 58-year-old father, Weluzani. He says, I wish I could get any formal job. I'm just barely making a living from this hustle of selling water so that my family can survive. But so far, everything is down, he says. He says, on a good day, they go home with $5 each, but other days, nothing. That is not the case with the 40-year-old Tafadzwa Gamanya in Goromonzi, a rural area about 50 kilometers east of Harare. A World Bank report says Zimbabweans living in rural areas are doing better than their counterparts in the urban areas thanks to subsistence farming. So is Gamanya. He says, this year is much better for us here. We had good rains. We have enough water to irrigate our crops until the next rain season. I have maize and sweet potatoes. My peas are at flowering stage. I sell my vegetables to get money for sugar, for tea, which we have with sweet potatoes. Our maize is enough for this year. We have nothing to ask or cry for, says Gamanya. Last week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government said the number of food insecure Zimbabweans had drastically fallen because of the good rains the country has enjoyed during the 2020-2021 agriculture season. Mukami Kariuki, who heads the World Bank in Zimbabwe, says the economy could recover faster depending on how the pandemic and the regional economy performs.
That Zimbabwe's economy is projected to grow at a faster pace than its neighbors, rising from 3.9% in 2021 to 5.1% in 2022. By comparison, the average growth rate for sub-Saharan Africa in 2021 is 2.8%. So overall, we note that the recovery of the economy is on a positive trend, and if sustained, this momentum will impact positively on the lives and livelihoods of the people of Zimbabwe.
An upward swing would be welcome news for Richard Luzani and millions of Zimbabweans like him. The World Bank reports 49% of the country's population now live in poverty due to both the pandemic and ailing economy. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
In northern Cameroon, Council of Traditional Rulers were all men, but in the last 2 years, women have been appointed as chiefs. These pioneer female deputy chiefs are battling early marriage in a region with Cameroon's highest rate of child marriage. Muki Edwin Kinzika narrates this report by Anne Nzuakiu in Mokolo, Cameroon.
2 years ago, Fadimatu Adamu's parents arranged her marriage as a 16-year-old to a man more than twice her age. Her husband often beat her, says Adamu, until she was rescued by the region's first female chiefs. She says she was suffering there and didn't even have enough to eat. It was Adja Kaigama, says Adamu, who gave money to her older sister Aisatu, who came to take her back home. Cameroon's Council of Traditional Rulers, or chiefs, are customarily men. But in the last 2 years, 11 women like Aja Kaigama Saidu have been appointed as deputy chiefs. While they are still under the direction of a higher-ranking male chief, Saidu says the new role means they can do more to help women.
Avec les femmes, on leur a expliqué comment elles peuvent même.
Their work with women is to explain to them how they can go through the deputy chiefs to express their needs at the level of the chiefdom, she says, and to denounce violence against women. Saidu says women have problems that they cannot express to men. It is through the women chiefs, she says, that they easily express their needs. The UN's Children's Fund says while more than a third of Cameroonian girls are married before the age of 18 and miss out on school, the rate jumps to 60% in the country's north. Student Aisatu Chanigi got pregnant when she was 15 years old. Her parents wanted to pull her out of school and marry her off, but the women chiefs convinced them otherwise.
Elles ont venu causer avec eux pour les convaincre, même si j'ai un enfant.
Chanigi says the women chiefs came to talk with her parents and convinced them that even if she has a child, if the parents do not abandon their daughter, she has the right, she has every chance in the world to succeed. It took 4 years of lobbying by the Association of Women and Girls of the Adamawa region, AFADA, to get the chiefdoms to agree to open to women. AFADA President Francois Baba says that since 2019, the female chiefs have helped hundreds of women and girls in cases of gender-based violence and to access health care and education.
Dans un village où nous avons désormais nos femmes notables.
She says in the villages where they now have women chiefs, the feedback they have received from schools is that the enrollment rate of young girls has increased by 40% for this school year. AFADA says they will continue to push for more women chiefs to reduce Cameroon's gender inequalities. For Anne Zwanke in Mokolo, Cameroon, Moki, Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
We'd love to hear what you think about this program. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We'll air your brief comments every Friday. We'll now leave you with the song Peter Aher by D. Kut.
Kai kol tilun wei
banru jengre
kwatu wei nyendugo kai bako kedwa leven
jengru jengre
akola panda bera wei
jengru jengre
ten jam mo mit ke sau su
jengru jengre
walun wei nyendugo
jengru jengre
wakai kot ke bai che dong
banru jengre
wakai kwanjul nengku tiam jul ya ku jama jama ngui lera wo da baba ben be yekada
pirit pirager pirager akornum
Piraer, piraer akor mat
wan ku pirchu ko mit ke bay sudan mel ku ne piro
piro kaneng ka korke
piro kaneng mike
ne piraer ukai kol chilun wei
banru jengre
wotu wei nyindugo kai bako ke dwaleven
jengre jengre
akola panda bera wei
jengre jengre
ben jambo mit ke sau su
jengre jengre
waluñ wei nyindugo
jengre jengre
wakai kot ke bai che dong
banru jengre
ku yak pingu yak jam ngenge jam yak jam we dorur yone pantuk aje ndor ku ne rai mit ke dingduk mat ke jeng ben ben bi apan moy akwa daka chin juru war wo.
We've been listening to D. Kut with the song Peer Aher. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Awanye pan pe yang irani yin dengeru dengeru lebih rai.